Well, good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation and this our 12th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster shooting pictures, Hai Wong Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melky. Thanks to Jonathan Jeffrey for arranging the use of the Western Room, not nearly adequate for the popularity of our tonight's speaker, and to Barnes & Noble for handling our book sale. Our speaker tonight is a native of Willard, Kentucky, near the West Virginia border. She grew up with a passion for teaching, which she pursued as an English major at Berea College in 1953. She was a student instructor in sophomore German in 1955, when she met her future husband, Jim Wayne, and invited him to join the Berea College's exclusive writing group, 20 Writers. After both had graduated, they were married on August 17, 1958. In 1960, they entered graduate school at Vanderbilt, where Mary Ellen received her MA and began work on her PhD, and the family moved to Bowling Green after the birth of her second son in 1963. Where she began a 5-decades-long career teaching English at Western while her husband taught German. Since then, she's cultivated several generations of writers, poets, and English teachers while publishing her own essays, reviews, articles, and poetry, and serving as faculty regent. In the 1980s, she, with Michael Lasseter as co-producer, won the Red Ribbon Award at the New York Film Festival for their documentary film, Poetry, A Beginner's Guide. In 2011, she won the Old 70 Creek Poetry Prize for her book, The Poet's Wife Speaks. Mary Ellen befriended me in 1987, and hearing that I was a Canadian, invited me to join her nascent Canadian Studies group, which she had founded with Anne Robson several years before. We eventually established a certificate program and received 14 grants from the Government of Canada and one from the Government of Quebec. And with her interest in Canadian literature, Mary Ellen traveled to Canada, where she met a rising star on the Canadian poetry scene, Bronwyn Wallace, who she invited to WKU in October 1988, just a year before the poet's death. That meeting was immortalized in one of Wallace's last poems, From Nashville to Mammoth Cave. And if you'll indulge me, I thought I would just read a portion of that poem. From Nashville to Mammoth Cave, all I know of Tennessee is the airport at Nashville, which is just like any airport anywhere. Fluorescent light and my life on fast forward, abrupt and public as the high gloss glitter on the luggage dropping onto that whirl around thing, spinning out all the possibilities of chance meetings, technicolor departures, all that, and Elvis too. He was everywhere. And that's how you knew it was Tennessee, summing up the state on t-shirts and coffee mugs, life-size and plastic and cardboard, as if you could cram enough of him in after his death to flesh out the rumor he was still alive. So much happening before the flash of my friend's arms, the parking lot, her car, and the bright lights of the Grand Old Opry on my left, heading into Kentucky, where moonlight made the grass even bluer than I could have imagined. Next morning, it was green again, like the green grass back home. The trees in the distance tinged with pink. It was October, like all the trees I've ever seen at that time of year. But the light, I like to believe was Kentucky light, the color of good corn whiskey, slow and luminous as the accents I was hearing all around me. Jim Wayne died in 1996 after winning acclaim as one of the giants of the Appalachian Literature Revival, a former poet laureate of Kentucky, and this past month was in 2015 inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. New generations of students will welcome this new collection of his works, Every Leaf a Mirror, a Jim Wayne Miller reader, which Mary Ellen has edited with Morris Grubbs for the University Press of Kentucky this past November. Please give a warm welcome to my friend and yours, Mary Ellen Miller.
Well, thank you for being here. Sorry the crowd is so sparse. We'll make do as best we can. That is a lot to live up to, Brian. There's things there I've forgotten that I've done, but I'm glad you know about them. Ladies and gentlemen, this was, as you might imagine, a tricky presentation for me to prepare. I think it always is if you're talking about someone you love, someone you lived with for 30-some years, someone who is multi-talented, someone who is the father of your children and father of your two grandchildren. It was hard for me in thinking about this to decide for those of you, the young people who didn't know him, didn't know who he was until just now, and you know quite a bit of him, quite a bit about him from Brian's introduction. Jim's last big honor, as Brian mentioned, was the being inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. And actually that was just last week. And I had the privilege of going to Lexington with my dear friend Lucinda and accepting for him. And in the same program was Wendell Berry accepting his induction into the Hall of Fame. But Wendell was the first living writer. All the other writers were deceased. He was the first living writer. And the committee never did exactly explain why they had chosen a living writer when they had not done that in the past. But I think it had something to do with swelling the crowd. I mean, I saw my department head one time announced that Wendell will be crossing the street down there, and then, you know, you'll have everybody there. But Wendell had said something that at first I didn't understand, but when I thought about it later, I did understand. He said, you know, this is a thrilling award for me, and very relieving. And nobody seemed, I didn't either, to know what he meant. And then I realized what he meant was, they think I'm alive, and, you know, I'm relieved, I'm here. And this confirms it, the only living writer. But let me tell you a little bit more about who Jim Windmiller was. He had a lot of good friends. Some of them are here tonight. A lot of people who knew him, maybe men especially, who knew him better than I did. But there is a poem written by a very close friend of his, Frank Steele. And it's a little bit long for me to read, but I thought I would read just the last part of it. And Frank's here. He didn't know I'm going to do this. Frank Steele speaking about Jim Windmiller. I remember his voice, warm enough to feel at home around a campfire or in the Kennedy Center. An original, Thoreau, Deerslayer. In the end, he belonged so deeply to one place that wherever he went, people speaking, oh, just any kind of American, took his voice to be their own. Isn't that lovely? That's Frank's beginning of Frank's poem. And I thank you very much for that, Frank. That'd be one of my treasures forever. The book is this book. It's a paperback, Every Leaf of Merrill, Jim Windmiller Reader, edited by me and Morris Grubbs. And the opening essay is by another very well-known writer and a close friend of Jim's, and that is Robert Morgan. So I thought I'd read, by way of introducing Jim to you through Robert Morgan's lens, a few sections of what Robert has to say. And this will teach you a little bit about the kind of work Jim did. Jim's poems showed from the beginning a fascination and even intimacy with death. His second book of poems was called Dialogue with a Dead Man. The poems reveal his vivid sense of history and the way poems speak across time, across generations, to the past, to the future. The poems are dialogues with the past, with American history, as well as with the interior self. Also, we begin to see Jim celebrate and honor and lament the passing of a way of life. And skipping ahead several paragraphs, Robert Morgan writes, Jim's poems are witty, clear-eyed, dramatic, and unsentimental. He is often a very experimental poet, trying new things with voice and form. His poems are charged with a relish for improvisation. I love the way he recovers the out of way and forgotten and celebrates the wisdom of work with hands. He can shout like a revival preacher or caller of a square dance. At the same time, he is a poet of informed political conscience and consciousness. Rereading his poems reminds us that he is not only a poet of the mountains, but of the planet. And there's much more to that beautiful essay, but I think that's enough to give you a sense of what other people have said about him. The afterword of this book was written by Silas House. Many of you know Silas's work, and it also is beautiful and touching. Morris Scrubs, my co-editor, selected the essays and the short stories. And there is one short story that I selected. And as a matter of fact, I finished the short story because I had discussed it with Jim and I kind of knew where he was taking it, but it wasn't finished at the time of his death. And it's a story about his travels with another Kentucky writer, very well-known Kentucky writer called James Steele. Some of you know James Steele? Well, James Steele was quite a bit older than Jim, but they got to be good friends, and they did a lot of traveling together. Steele was 30 years older than Jim. They went to Europe two or three different times. They went to the Yucatan a couple of times. And bit by bit, Jim learned what his importance was to Mr. Steele, as we always called him. He called us by our first names, which was to be his luggage bearer, to run down three flights of stairs if he'd left his pajamas in the car or something. He really became kind to feel like sort of a servant to James Steele. And the story was about that. The story is about that. It's in here. It's called Truth and Fiction. But he hadn't quite finished it, but he and I had talked about it. So I decided to finish it, staying as close as I could to what I knew he was doing. And I'm real happy with that story, because I think it shows a side of James Steele that needed to be shown. And that side was, it was, that he was sort of a big baby. And I didn't know when I first got to know him that he was one of 12 children. He was the 12th. And the only boy. So it explains so much to me. But I loved him anyway. He was witty, he's delightful, he's incredibly talented. But Jim had told him one year that he simply could not go to Europe with him that year because he'd been away from home so much, and it was just, you know, we just couldn't do it. So later, Steele came to our house to spend the night. I think he was on his way to Nashville, and he was still driving by himself, but he didn't want to go the whole way, and he was going to spend the night and have dinner with us. So I asked Jim, what would he want for dinner? What does he like? And Jim said, everything. Just be sure there's lots of it. And I thought, well, you know, it's kind of chilly. Chicken and dumplings. I bet he'd like chicken and dumplings. And I said, what if I fix chicken and dumplings? And Jim said, doesn't matter. Just be sure there's lots of it. And he was right. But anyway, we were sitting, I had the food going, and we were sitting around having a drink, the three of us, before dinner. Jim and I were having a drink. Mr. Steele was having three drinks. And we had wine with dinner as well. But sometime during that evening before we ate, he said, Mary Ellen, would you like to go to Europe with me next fall? And I really was sort of overcome by it. So I said, well, of course I would love to. What an honor. Thank you. Thank you so much. And he said, I swear his very words, as close to his enunciation as I can get, he said, well, I need somebody to carry my luggage and to handle the passports and all that stuff that I don't like to do. So I began to see what Jim had been talking about in his story then. But they loved each other. And the irony was, at the end of that story, Truth and Fiction, Jim, as the younger writer, as he says in the story, had come to kind of understand where this older man, 30 years older, was coming from. He had been petted and he had been babied, but he was basically very kind-hearted and gentle and good. And the story ends with the younger writer, and they're kind of reconciled. They had a spat, which even a little spat with Steele was, very disheartening to him. But it ends on a peaceable note, and the character which represents Jim is saying, even then I was thinking of adjectives I might use in a final tribute to this incredibly gifted man. And the irony of that is that although Steele was 30 years older, Jim died first, and it was Steele who came to Jim's funeral and paid him a tribute. So one of the stories, I'm telling you that so you know that one of these stories is one that, all the stories are Jim's, but that's one that's sort of Jim and me. I divided the poetry into sections. A lot of people say that editing a book is a simple task compared to writing one, and I might have said that myself at one time, but I don't think that's true now. Making these selections from his poetry, grouping them into sections, which I never thought about grouping them or whether they fell into sections of any kind or not, was hard. It's hard work. And then labeling, finding names for those sections was difficult. But I did it, and I feel pretty good about the way I did it, because the book has gotten some very nice reviews. And I am going to tell you what some of those sections are and read a little bit from them. The names might seem a little bit strange to you. The first one is called Miracle and Mystery. And there is a thread in Jim's poetry of the mystical. He wasn't a very religious man, wasn't a religious man at all. But he was interested in the mystical and mysterious and in the inexplicable. So there is a section called Miracle and Mystery. And in that section is a poem called The Faith of Fishermen. That one I will read. He loved to fish. I don't think I ever met anyone in my life who was more fanatic about it. He was a fanatic about it. The Faith of Fishermen. What they see when they go down to the base of the dam in rubber suits with helmets, airlines and weighted shoes to inspect the 26 gates in clear away debris. What they see, the divers say, we wouldn't believe. Catfish. They shake their heads, remembering. Catfish lying like logs around those gates, up close against the concrete. Catfish with heads as big as buckets. We don't mess with them. 80, 100, 120 pounders, yellow eyes that glow in the underwater beam. But we believe. The divers are our priest. Ours is the faith of fishermen, eager for any authoritative word. We need to know wonders are still alive at the base of the steel and concrete world we made. A yellow-eyed, whispered wildness, something old and other, akin to what we feel, powerful, cold, living in the dark around the gates that regulate the rivers of our lives. That's one of my favorites and one of many people's favorites. I'm not going to be able to read as many as I would like to, but I hope I read enough to interest you in this book and in the kind of poet Jim was. There's a section called Family, Children, and so on. And there's a poem called A House of Readers. And I'm reading this for Jonathan. Where are you, Jonathan? Jonathan Jeffrey. We crowded him out.
He's waving his hand.
Can you hear me, Jonathan? This is what he specifically asked me to read because he likes it so much. The House of Readers. At 9:42 on this May morning, the children's rooms are concentrating too. Like a tendril growing toward the sun, Ruth moves her book into a wedge of light, a wedge of light that settles on the floor like a butterfly. She turns the page. Fred is immersed in magic, cool as a black Angus belly deep in a farm pond. The only sounds, pages turning softly. This is the quietness of bottomland, when you can hear only the young corn growing, where a little breeze stirs the blades and then breathes in again. I mark my place, I listen, like a farmer in the rows. I like that poem a lot too. That's in the section called Family, Love, Marriage, Children. One more from that section, and this also is about our daughter. I think it's one of my favorites. She left home at the usual age to go to college, and she went pretty far. She went to San Francisco, which is where she did all her work. And I went with her. I mean, we didn't just go down to Nashville and stick her on a plane, you know. I said, I'm going with her. But I just tore Jim all the pieces, evidently, so. Not my leaving, but her leaving. And probably hoped I wouldn't come back. Traveling. Someone you love leaves early one morning. You still hear the big jet's high-pitched whine in tires keening you home. You feel her go again in the blast of big trucks passing, again riding their heaving wave of fumes, wake of fumes. At home, her cat at her door meows the jet's whine, its tail curling like smoke. The cat comes to you, sits looking up. When you take her on your lap and stroke her, engines headed west in her throat. This going, pain that clutches, now sharp as cat claws, now dull ache of this wisdom tooth. Her absence, this cool spell at the end of summer, this wind streaming like a cruising jet, his own heart hurtling through the cold. I think that's one of the most powerful and most personal of Jim's poems. Maybe I'll read a couple more and then see if you would like to discuss this book a little bit or discuss who this man was. Someone who knows his work want to ask me to read a particular poem?
About a Briar poem.
The Briar poems, who was that? Was that you, David? The Briar poems are awfully long. Let me see if I can find one that's not too long. Okay. Where is Shay? Shay has a poem that I think is lovely, except for the last line. You remember when we talked about this in class? And it's about, it's just beautifully done, it's about the lines in a poem, but they're ridges, they're trenches, you know, they're really serious, serious demarcations. And at the end of it, we find out that it is a poem, it's a poem reading. And everybody in the class said, "That's lovely, that's great." And I said, "No, it's not." But he knows what I meant. I mean, you turned it into a riddle, you know, and the reader was expecting something big and serious, not a little jokey thing at the end. So he understood. And that's what's important. He's working on that line. So Jim has a poem called The Briar Riddle, and it's short. So I'm reading it for you, David, and you better understand what he's talking about, or I'll be humiliated. Briar Riddle. For a long time he lived like a frog in my pocket. In a black forest, a lost girl came and kissed him into a handsome prince. Since then, he has been living off a generous patrimony, a one-eyed king in a country of blind fingers. Brian gets it. Shay, you talking about did you follow that? Raunchiness wasn't Jim's usual style, but he made an exception for that. And I read that just for David. What? You said read it again? No, Kaylin, if you don't catch on, nope, that was your one opportunity.
Dang it.
Any other requests? Somebody, let's show.
If you might tell us how you your meeting and what Jim was doing at Berea, and you're from Kentucky, but how did he come to be there?
A recruiter came to his high school and talked him into going there, and we met there. As you already mentioned, Joe, what were you going to say?
I can't think of the name of it, Marion, but the Briar goes to Cincinnati, the furniture maker.
What is the title of that poem? I think it's called The Chairmaker. But I don't think it's in here, Joe. I don't remember that it is. It isn't. So, other requests?
I
I got it now, by the way.
It's called Jocelyn, helped you. I don't know what to do with that girl. Now, Joe, I'm sorry that that's not here. Any other possible request? Here's a long poem that, trust me, I'm not going to read it to you, it's pages and pages. And it's called The Briar Sermon. That's what David was saying about the Briar poems. The Briar, is a nickname that people north of us. Did you ever hear that word, Dave?
Yes.
Or hillbillies?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Jim's character is the Briar. The sermon is the Briar sermon, and it is someone who has been dislocated, going north to look for work and so on. And it's very, very long. It has been performed almost like a voice play. And it's very effective, but of course I can't read that. But I was just interested to know if you were familiar with that term, Briar.
I heard people use it in Indiana.
In Indiana, but not in Ohio.
We were more sophisticated.
That's what I knew you were going to say, so I gave you the opportunity to do so. I hope you appreciate it. There's a little story I wanted to tell you. I found, actually Morris found, something Jim had written back in the 70s. And he was really struck with it because it does kind of encapsulate some of the things Jim is doing in his poetry and in his fiction. Jim wrote, "I am in love with the commonplace. I love to make it shine by holding it in the right light." And I just thought that was lovely. You know, a lovely thing to say. And then my granddaughter, our granddaughter, who would never have seen that, I hadn't even seen that quote, she would never have seen it, she was 2 years old when Jim died, but she's an art major, and she did an etching, diploma etching, which she entitled, "He Told Me to Enshrine the Minuscule." And when I saw that etching, she gave it to him for Christmas, and the little inscription was part of it, and I thought, it's like Jim had spoken to her from the grave. You see the similarity in it. And I knew he hadn't spoken to her from the, at least I didn't think he had. But I said, "Where'd you get that title? Did one of your professors assign that to you?" "He told me to enshrine the minuscule." "Is it your art professor?" And she said, no, I just liked what I was doing there, and I was, you know, depicting little minuscule things in this abstract drawing. And she said, "I just like giving it the title, He Told Me to Enshrine the Minuscule." So naturally, I had to take Jim's quote, this was in the front part of the book, and use her, or try to get the press to use the etching with her statement on it. And those of you who publish books know that no matter how good your idea is, you the publisher or the editor will think it's not very good. So I had to enlist outside help. Other people, they knew other people whose books they had published who would say, "That is fantastic. That just makes a wonderful opening for the book." So there it is. Sometimes you have to get people with influence to help you do what you wanted to do in the first place. But I don't know anybody with influence now, so. No, that's not true. Is it Dr. Hale? There's an interview with Beloyal Jones that has some extremely interesting comments of Jim's, I think. Some things about him I didn't know until I read that interview. And I just think, I hope if you have a chance to buy this book, that you will enjoy it as much as I did. I'm leaving some time for discussion. And, you know, I've told Molly I don't like something called question and answer so much as it sounds like a news conference. But I do like talking and discussing books and having you bring up anything that you might like to bring up now, other than what we've already talked about.
Orchestrate it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's not a question. I just missed out on getting to see if you'd read a poem. I was wondering if you'd read Spring Storm.
No.
No. She would say that to me.
I do anything Derek asks me to do, don't we all? Yeah, I considered reading that one. I like that poem. A Spring Storm. I probably have had more requests to reprint that poem than any other poem in this book. And a lot of those requests have come from testing services. I got one just the other day from the Minnesota Testing Service. And they wanted to include it, you know, in their statewide test. And I've had that request for other poems too. And they are looking for good poems, I assume, and for poems that are accessible to high school kids. So, of course, I always say yes. And, of course, they always send me a nice little check. Got one just the other day. Spring Storm. He comes gusting out of the house, the screen door, a thunderclap behind him. He moves like a black cloud over the lawn and stops. A hand in his mind grabs a purple crayon of anger and messes the clean sky. He sits on the steps, his eye drawing a mustache on the face in the tree. As his weather clears, his rage dripping away, wise cracks and wonderment spring up like dandelions. And that is a nice poem. That's about Frederick Lucinda when he was little. Not now. Molly?
I want to hear more of Jim's origin story. How did he start writing, and what's the earliest poem in the book that he wrote?
The earliest poem he wrote, I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know which. I know sort of the chronology a little bit, but I would not be able to answer that without going back. That little epigraph that I mentioned is one of the earliest things he wrote, you know, I'm in love with the commonplace. But that wasn't a whole poem.
Did he write before he got to Berea, or was that when you got him to join the Writers Club? How did he start writing?
I think he wrote all his life. He was very enterprising. He grew up in the West, in the mountains. Started to say hills, he would kill me for that. I always said I was from the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, and he said, those aren't mountains. Those are hills. But he grew up in the mountains of Western Kentucky, and he was a very enterprising young man in earning money. When he was 16, he bought himself a car. He paid his dad for the insurance, you know, that his dad had gotten on it. So how did he make money? You know, he was sort of, they were kind of out in the country, they lived on a big farm, which is a story in itself. It's a farm that once had belonged to his paternal grandfather, and the maternal grandfather was a sharecropper on the paternal grandfather's side of the family, so it's sort of interesting. But it was from his maternal grandfather, Grandfather Smith, that he learned to hunt and fish and trap. And none of those things, well, fishing's not illegal now, but there's a limit on how much you can take sometimes. But none of those things were illegal. So he trapped and sold furs, meat and fox out of the mountains there. It's pretty lucrative. And fish, he didn't sell, he just fished because he loved to sell, to fish. And none of those things were illegal, the hunting, the trapping, nothing was illegal. And they were fairly remunerative. But he found another, even more remunerative occupation. He's still a teenager, still in high school, which was illegal. And he and a friend of his did this anyway. Anybody want to guess what they did? What?
I thought it would be moonshine.
Well, you were absolutely right. They found an old still, abandoned still in the mountains, he and his friend, Ted Meadows, whom I've met, and repaired it and found out from somebody how to make moonshine. And then they sold it in quart jars. They stole out of his mother's canning house, I guess. Saved on their out, you know, on their expenses to do that. I don't really know that part. I just made that up. But I know that his parents died not ever knowing that he was doing this. His mother lived being her 90s. She only died a couple years ago. And I used to always say, I'm going to tell her that sometime. I say, you didn't pay much attention to your children, did you? Growing up, what kind of mother were you? But I never got around to it. But not only did they make moonshine and sell it, they took it across the state lines because the best market was in Tennessee. These two teenage boys hauling their wares over into Tennessee. It makes me break out and show up. I don't know how he managed. There's a picture of him somewhere, Brian. Maybe it's on his webpage, I don't know. But he's standing at a blackboard, has a kind of plaid jacket on, and he's laughing. You seen that picture? Well, it looks like he's writing some kind of equation or something. He's writing out a description of how to make moonshine. He was teaching another crop of people how to do that, evidently. But I've known that since we were in college together. And I certainly didn't dare tell our sons because they would have. It was enough that they mixed my spices in little sacks and sold them around the neighborhood. As far as they went.
How did he and Jim still become friends?
Oh, very good friends. Oh, how did they become friends? At Hyman Settlement School. You know, James Steele was the writer in residence up there. And Jim did workshops up there every summer. And that's how they got to be good buddies and friends. And they were good buddies and good friends, despite some traits of James Steele's that can be pretty aggravating. But he, in final analysis, he was a generous-hearted, kind man. But he was a mysterious man, too, because he had written every wonderful thing. I'm talking about James Steele now. He had written his novels and his poems were all done while he was fairly young. Then he went into the war. He's in World War II. And he was in battle. And one of the trips he wanted to make was back to the World War II battlefields in France and in Germany, and one of the places that Jim took him to. But after, and everybody knows him well, knows this, after World War II, after he came home from World War II, he just sort of stopped writing. But he pretended to be writing. And he'd do a poem here and a poem there, and he'd talk about the big one, you know, the big book he was working on. No, he wasn't. But something happened to him. He wasn't wounded, but just the horror of it. He did see battle. I mean, he was in battle. And he said himself that he didn't exactly know altogether why the writing impulse had pretty much left him, although he continued to write some poetry, essays, and they were good. But it's a mystery still. It's a mystery of my life. I know some of you are familiar with work of James Steele. Okay, do we have... Yeah, we do. We got more time.
One of the questions we've heard a lot of is that Jim was such a literary person, but taught German, and that question has come up. Why wasn't he in the English department? That was it.
Well, we had this horrible department head, as we always have had. They've just been terrible people. And he applied there, but they turned him down. No. Well, he had a double major, I did too, in German and English. And Vanderbilt just made him an offer he couldn't refuse in German. And we talked about it, and he said, well, why not? You know, why not? I'm going to be writing, and maybe teaching writing is not the best route for me. Maybe just teaching German and German language and literature is a better way to go. And he never regretted that. And he was a scholar of German language and literature. He loved the great German poets. And he wrote his dissertation on a 19th century Austrian poet, Annette von Dosta-Hülshoff. And I think its title is Metaphorical Strategies in the Early Poems of Annette von Dosta-Hülshoff.
You got to say that quick.
Yeah. I got to say that pretty quickly, yeah. But he was a scholar as well as a poet and a fiction writer and an essayist and so on. But that's the story behind that,
Brian. That's the story. She's sticking to it. Yeah.
I am sticking to it.
Other questions? Yes, yeah. Back here.
What is your favorite of your husband's works, and could you read it for us?
You know, I have. Of the poems, I think my favorite is the poem, although I was kidding him about it, In Absentia. I hope. Traveling is one of my favorite poems. The one about our daughter leaving home, because I think that's one of the most powerful.
Want to do one more?
I'll do one more. Let me have a look here at others. Well, actually, I kind of put my favorites in here. I'll take another one from the children's and family section. This one is called Living with Children. Sorcerers, they've turned the house into a serialized fairy tale. The plot, full of reversals, mysterious messages, unfolds day after day, surprising as fried marbles underfoot. A frog on the floor waiting to be kissed. A rabbit, a pet snake. Half a sandwich shelved with books. Ghosts, guns, flowers. Winged, web-footed snakes strung on the walls of bedrooms, their caves. There is an enchanted forest inhabited by Crayola people who fear the heat of the sun and never venture from under their Crayola trees. So different from the watercolor folk who live in an eternal spring standing forever in watercolor puddles, hands reaching up to a sun that looks down on them, a blissful idiot. In my desk drawer, an unfamiliar piece of paper that accordions out. Don't touch this or you'll die. It's too late. That's another one.
Maybe on that note, we'll bring this to a close. And we are going to give away a copy of, and I'm sure Mary Ellen would be pleased to autograph a copy outside here at the end.
I surely will.
And a little token of our appreciation. We hope you'll join with me and thanking our speaker, Mary Ellen Miller.
Oh.
We want to thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll join us next Thursday. We'll be at Barnes & Noble to hear about a remarkable story about an architect rebuilding Haiti at San Michael. Thank you and have a good evening.
Thank you, Brian, so much for everything.